in all likelihood, that underrepresented kid probably doesn't even know we exist. And so we can put in a little bit more effort to let them know that we exist. So without messing with the algorithm and without sort of focusing, you know, messing on the purity of that, we can still try and, you know, get to the outcomes that we're looking for by putting a bigger effort in where we market.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
For years now, I've heard about the problems with funding entrepreneurship and how the funding landscape is broken. And to that end, I wanted to speak with Andrew D'Souza. He's the co-founder and CEO of Clearco, the world's largest e-com investor and unicorn valued at approximately $2 billion. After years of witnessing founder challenges in the VC world, Andrew saw an opportunity to modernize the funding system. Traditional access to funding is biased. It's based off of assets, connections, and exponential forecasts. And Clearco is attempting to remove those barriers. So I wanted to talk to Andrew about his mission to democratize capital, how the funding landscape is going to be evolving over the next few years, and how Clearco uses data to create an unbiased approach to funding. Andrew, welcome to Future Proof.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. First thing I wanted to ask you is, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis? How do you define yourself and your work?
Yeah, great question. I'm increasingly trying to not define myself purely by my work, but, you know, I'm the co-founder and CEO of Clearco. We are the largest revenue-based financing partner for e-commerce businesses and have really sort of tried to find alternative ways of funding and unlocking opportunities for entrepreneurs and founders of online businesses around the world.
And how about when we're not thinking with the work lens? Because as you said, I think it's hard not to define yourself that way when you're probably working, you know, I don't want to guess 19, 20 hours a day, but maybe it's an unhealthy number some on occasion. So yeah. What's something that people don't know about you that maybe you haven't admitted on an interview previously?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I'm an engineer and I always used to think of myself as a very logical person, but I think as I've grown older, I find that I'm actually much more of a creative. And I look for, you know, I've got a wild imagination. I love to look for creative outlets. I've got a guitar amp in my background here. I try and play a little bit of and improvise a little bit of music here and there. I try and do a little bit of stand up or improv comedy, but yeah, I probably am an improviser both at work and at play. That's probably the easiest way to define myself in, you know, in music, in sports, in life, and in business. So that's probably, I've ever introduced myself that way in the past, but there you go.
Nice. I'll take it. I know that Clearco's stated mission is to make funding more accessible to a wider range of entrepreneurs. Not that I disagree at all, but why is that important and how did you come to that conclusion?
Yeah, it's, I think of it as entrepreneurs are people who see the world as possibility, what, you know, a better version of the world, what it could be, and people who are trying to create that future for themselves and for everybody that they, you know, interact with and for all of humanity. And so right now, the people that get the chance to go create that future are a relatively narrow band of the people who would like that opportunity. And so I think of our mission as widening that aperture, so that more people have the opportunity, which is access to the resources and access to the knowledge and advice and, you know, whatever it takes to go create the future that they want. And if we've got a million people around the world who otherwise, you know, wouldn't have that opportunity, now that are able to, we think that the future could end up being much brighter for everybody. And so, you know, in a lot of ways to sharpen it, we think of our mission as, you know, how do we back a million entrepreneurs and a million founders and help them go create the future that they imagine?
Which I think it's obviously laudable, and I'm going to kind of break down that just to kind of challenge it a little bit in a few questions. But I think wanted to maybe backtrack for a second and actually ask you a little bit about how is our modern funding system antiquated in a sense? Because I realize that I'm probably closer to this and you're certainly closer to this than a lot of people. And I think they might not realize how the system that we have right now does have some bias in it. And also it just has a lot of imperfections that you're trying to really address.
Yeah, the current VC sort of funding model. I mean, look, I'll give you, you know, a bit of a story. So I was born in India. My dad went to, for people that are listening, IIT and IIM, which were really good schools in India to get into. And him and his friends would talk about what they would do if they could start a company, right? And ideas, and, you know, it was the early days of not even the internet, but software. And Most of them couldn't. They had no idea how to start a company and where to get the resources to start a company. They didn't have, you know, family money and things. One of his friends ended up moving to Silicon Valley and met Vinod Khosla and ended up starting a company that ended up being Juniper Networks. Now, but he had to basically pick up his whole life, move to the Valley, and everyone else, you know, got jobs to support their families. I ended up growing up, my family moved to Canada so that I had a better opportunity. And I went to the University of Waterloo, which was, again, you know, pretty good engineering school. I remember my friends and roommates, we had the same conversations about, hey, you know, wouldn't it be great? This is just as like iOS, you know, the iPhone was coming out and Android had just launched. Like, oh, you know, what if we create an app? What would we do? Well, what kind of business would that be? You know, we saw Facebook get funded. It was like, oh, this is super interesting. We had no idea how to do that though. Like, what's the process? In Canada, we, you know, back then there wasn't really much of a venture capital ecosystem. And so we all got jobs and one of our friends ended up moving to the Valley and he ended up starting Instacart and Apoorva ended up doing super well with that. And so, you know, for like generations, it was this idea that you had to go on this pilgrimage to Silicon Valley, to where the VCs were, if you wanted to have any hope of creating a future that, you know, for yourself and for the world. And the reason for it, I think, is partly because it's a very human-driven system. You've got, you know, LPs and endowment funds that give money to a very small handful of people who are entrusted with allocating that capital to the people that are going to create the future. And so, you know, VCs only have so many hours in the day. They can only take so many meetings. They can only sit on so many boards and make so many investments. And so in order to make that time most efficient, you know, like anybody, they look for shortcuts on how do I make sure that every meeting that I take is the highest impact? And the best way to do that is to go through a trusted referral. Oh, well, I got this referral from somebody I went to school with. I got this referral from a childhood friend. I got this referral from somebody who I used to work at Google with, right? Like that's who gets on the calendars of the investors who make the decisions. And, you know, that works well if you can get through that referral network. And if you went to those schools, you go to those parties, or you run those circles. But if you're graduating from, you know, school in India or Indonesia or Kenya, the odds that you're going to be able to navigate your way to that have nothing to do with how qualified you are to actually go and create, you know, a better future and how, you know, the caliber of your idea, the level of your ambition, your work ethic, your talent level. And so I think that's where widening that aperture, instead of it being all of this money trying to go through a very thin straw to go through a handful of entrepreneurs who can get to the other side, can we make that straw wider so that more people have the opportunity to go and take their shot?
I really like that. One thing, and I know that this obviously did not necessarily solve everything, but did COVID have any type of positive silver lining with respect to democratizing fundraising? And the reason why I say that is because I have heard of people who didn't go to Silicon Valley, and surely there was still networking involved, but they started raising funds on Zoom, and all of a sudden that was a thing. And I'm just wondering, certainly not enough, but did that help push things in the right direction at all?
Yeah, I think it certainly made it more accessible and leveled the playing field. I think this idea that, yeah, you had to go on this pilgrimage and go up and down Sand Hill Road is a bit of an antiquated, especially for a technology-focused industry. So I'm, you know, very happy about that. Now, I think that you still have to work through the networks, right? You still have to get the right introduction. For the first little bit of COVID, most investors weren't investing in anybody they hadn't met in person. So they were still taking meetings, but they had to have met the people in person. I think that changed over the past, you know, several months. But I do think that it's made it much easier. So you can pitch your business. You can reach many more investors. You don't have to, you can take more pitches during the day. Both the investors and the entrepreneurs can meet many more people than they used to be able to. So I think that has definitely had a positive effect. But I still think that there is a challenge of, you know, as long as it's a human-driven allocation model, you're still going to have a relatively narrow aperture of the types of entrepreneurs and the types of businesses that are going to get funded.
And I know that there's everybody has secret sauce or something that they purport to be that. You know, in looking at what you guys do, it seemed that making decisions based off of fundraising in a more blind way that's algorithmically based, that seems to be part of it. But tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's the idea. Is look, we don't pass judgment on whether we would buy your product. If you can find your customers in an efficient way and they love your product, we will fund you. We had a great story, joined our all hands yesterday, of Joanna Griffiths from Knixware, and you know, they were the first business to build leak-proof underwear for women, and she was telling us about, you know, pitching investors, mostly male, you know, middle-aged investors who had never experienced this. And you walk into you pitch somebody who just doesn't relate to the problem you're trying to solve, even though it literally affects 50% of the population. But if the person who's passing judgment on your business can't relate viscerally to the problem you're solving, you're just not going to get the credit for it. And so that's where taking that bias out and just looking at the economics and the numbers, her business has always had stellar economics because she's solving a meaningful problem for a lot of the population. You know, I think that's where we can actually help unlock things and make the journey a little bit easier for people.
You know, what's really interesting to me about that is that I think people have this incorrect assumption about VCs and, you know, just people who are, you know, funding businesses in general, that they are always making decisions that are in their best financial interests. And they're essentially, you know, we're forgetting that we're human and that we do make mm-hmm. decisions based off of who do we like more or what can we viscerally understand as a problem more. And I'm sure that there are some people who looked at her business and on some level got that it was a problem and it was a market opportunity and yet didn't invest because it didn't hit them in that way. And it's just interesting how, you know, even these very capitalist individuals will not make decisions that are in their wallet's best interest.
Well, you've got to, I mean, you think about the dynamics of a partnership. Look, VCs are human and they're hired for their intuition and judgment, right? And so that's, you know, their experience and their ability to pattern match and, you know, look for the next Zuckerberg. And when, you know, that works. When you look for the next Zuckerberg, you find Evan Spiegel and you end up doing really well when you fund Snapchat. So it's not a bad strategy, but you think about the dynamics of a VC partnership and you need to have conviction because you have to probably go and pound the table with your partners to do the deal, right? An average VC does what, 10 deals a year. They've got, you know, 3 to 5 partners and, you know, maybe sometimes more. And so every partner maybe gets to do 2 deals a year. And so you have to have enough conviction, enough passion to pound the table for why the deal you're bringing to the table should be one of those 10 slots. And if you're not excited about solving the problem, if you don't viscerally and emotionally feel connected to the mission and the problem that the entrepreneur is solving, you're just not going to be able to make that case to your partnership. And that's just human dynamics. And so, again, it's, you know, it's no fault of the individuals that are VCs. It's a structural setup of the industry. And the industry has performed really well. So there's no reason, like, they don't need to change it. But it's if the goal is creating great returns for LPs, it's working. But if the goal is enabling entrepreneurship and mass globally, it's only part of the solution.
And I know that there's been a lot of talk lately about algorithms and, you know, how they can advance society, but they also have the potential to be flawed. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm talking about algorithms in general, not just yours, of course, but can an algorithm be flawed? And if so, how does somebody like you work against that happening when you're building it and refining it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if there's an inherent bias in the data set, you're just going to replicate that in the algorithm. And so I think that, you know, one of the things, like, this is one of the, when you have a totally blind algorithm, you have no idea what it's doing in a true sort of self-directed machine learning environment, then you'll end up where it's like, okay, well, I didn't realize that somebody's eye color is correlated to their returns. And so I'm going to pull out eye color and I'm going to drive that. We have a little bit more structure around this. So, you know, we don't necessarily look at, you know, we don't look at every characteristic about the individual. Like, if you, like, this happens in things like consumer lending, where, you know, somebody's postal code or, you know, like, last name or whatever ends up being correlated to consumer lending risk. And so there are a bunch of disclosure requirements around that. We are really looking at the business in a vacuum and the business data. And so, you know, theoretically, and again, maybe this is being a bit like robotic, but we could say, like, you could replace the founder. It's almost like, okay, well, this founder, we don't actually look at a lot of the details about the founder. And this is the difference between us and VC, because VC, you've got to look at you've got to really understand the founder and the business owner more so than even the business. We're sort of the opposite, where we're like, look, we just don't care about the fundamentals of the business. We don't care who you are. We don't care what you look like. We don't care how eloquent you pitch. We don't care how good of a storyteller you are. We just care about, do you have fundamentals in the business? You know, if you put a dollar in, can you get more than a dollar out? And if you do, then great. We want to continue to help you do that more and more. So it's a different look. It's a different type of capital for a different type of business and for a different use case. But we think it's an important thing because there's many, many entrepreneurs that have very, very solid businesses that get overlooked by VC because they don't know how to articulate how it's going to be a $10 billion company.
And building on that, because I think you're right. I think that not everything has to be a $10 billion company. You know, it can very well be something that has a pretty good growth trajectory and lower risk. And maybe that's actually okay sometimes, which I've always, it seems to me very interesting that everybody's kind of trying to build the same type of company, which is a dominant player that is high risk, high reward. And maybe there's mm-hmm. something in between. And, you know, building on that, I'm wondering, in a more just world, how do you envision the demographics of entrepreneurship shifting, and how can that be a benefit to us all?
Yeah, I would love for the demographics to reflect the demographics of the world, right? I think that's really our mission, is like, let's look at what, you know, the human population, what that breakdown looks like, and let's see if we can have more entrepreneurs and more people that are shaping that future look similar to what that, you know, the global demographic looks like. I think what ends up happening is, you know, solving problems that matter to more people, right? And that matter to different types of people, like, you know, issues that are affecting people, like health issues and climate issues. And there are lots of things that affect different people in different ways that, you know, again, if in sort of the major financial hubs of the world, they don't relate to, probably don't get funded, but they could affect, you know, millions, billions of people in some cases. And so there's a massive market opportunity and a great reason to solve those problems.
And it's interesting. I think I saw the data from you guys that your company allocated 13% of its capital to companies founded by Black and Latinx founders, individuals, compared to only 2.6% allocated by traditional VC firms. And tell me if I'm wrong about those numbers, but as I was looking at it, I'm thinking, well, in terms of the Black and Latinx population of the U.S., let's say, and I know mm-hmm. that we're not just talking U.S., but that's like 35% or so maybe of the country, give or take. And then 2.6%, it's like, are people thinking that that large of a population has that few ideas? It just seems crazy to me.
Yeah, I think it is. Look, it's a system. I mean, look, so we're at 13%, so we're not at 35, but we're working towards it. And I think it's exactly that. It's you know, we're one of the biggest things is building awareness that, like, there are, you know, there are communities that have unique problems that they and unique perspectives on the world, and they want to go create a future as well. And so part of our mission is just letting people know and building awareness that these options exist, because I think for a lot of, you know, Black and Latinx and you know, marginalized founders, they just think that venture capital is you know, the same thing as my dad and me and my friends in school. Like, it's just so far out there, I wouldn't even know where to start. And so, you know, I'm not going to be able to start my own business, or if I do, it's got to be on my off of whatever I can save. There's no sources of funding available to me. And so I think that's as ClearCo and other organizations like ours, you know, start to build momentum. And as we start to have success stories from those communities, I think we will start to, you know, people will start to build more awareness, and hopefully we'll move closer and closer to, you know, reflect that population, that percentage of the population. And so I think, you know, that's certainly a big part of our objective. The interesting thing is we didn't do any of this top down, right? It wasn't like, okay, we're going to allocate, you know, 10% to this community and 20% to this community. It was just, we're going to go tell people, hey, we're open for business. And if you have a great business, we want to fund it and get the word out. And the people that show up are, you know, more reflective of the population.
Yeah. And to that point, I know that global funding for female founders dropped by 27% last year. And during that time, trying to have that blind approach, ClearCo funded 8 times as many female-led companies as the industry average, which I thought a impressive stat. And then got me thinking, what could the world look like if we had more female entrepreneurs? If we had more women as entrepreneurs, would the general dynamic of entrepreneurship look different? Would the types of companies that pop up look different, you know, at large? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, well, I mean, one, you know, women have empathy for different types of problems than just men do, right? And so, you know, Joanna from Nix was an example, but there are all kinds of other problems that they can actually understand, and they have different views on the world and everything. And so I think the idea is, what if we could enable more female founders to go build businesses? I mean, I think there's all kinds of stats around the success of female-led businesses over, or at least the success and failure rate of women-led businesses over male-led businesses, or purely or solely male-led, or you know, I think those are some of the areas that we're really starting to focus on. Is just like, how do we create more opportunities for more diverse founding teams? And yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the areas. I mean, I'm hopeful that we end up with a more diverse types of companies and more tolerant types of companies and companies that are solving different types of problems. I think, you know, for us, and again, we're fortunate. I've got, you know, Michelle is an amazing business partner and founder for the company, and we've built an excellent sort of leadership and executive team with, you know, a lot of diversity. And then being in a mostly Canadian company, global diversity, we've got people who speak every language, look every skin tone, and have many have not been born in North America. But that perspective, I think, makes us a much stronger company and makes us much more empathetic for our founders as well.
There's a quote that I read from you, and I thought that this was just really interesting, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase, but you say essentially, we have a role not only as consumers, but as responsible investors to effect positive change in the space. And with respect to a particular investment, say, this investment also reflects our commitment to democratizing capital for, you know, women-owned brands in that case, but, you know, just in general, democratizing capital. And it got me thinking, this is, again, something I happen to, on a personal level, completely agree with, but then because I know not everybody agrees, even the people who listen to Future Proof. And I'm wondering, why should investors care about society? You know, what responsibilities do they have to it? Is this something going to be more important in the future? You know, like, convince me that it's not a blip, but it's more of a long-term trend.
Yeah, it's a great look. I mean, I think I have to often switch between hats of my own personal beliefs and my responsibilities to investors and the people that are and shareholders and the people that are backing me. And so I think every time that I try and do this, it's about aligning those interests. And I think, you know, even if you are looking at this purely from a return on investment standpoint, your customers, your employees, your stakeholders, the media is holding businesses to a different standard than it did, you know, decades ago. The talent that you're trying to attract has many, many more options, especially in a global world. The type of people and the high caliber people that are going to give you an edge as a business could go work at many different places for the same economic incentive package and upside that you're offering them. And so in that world, what differentiates you is the sort of moral compass of the business or the mission, and finding people who are mission aligned. That's where you're going to attract the best people and get the best work out of them, is that they really believe that they're doing their life's work, and that their efforts are going towards making the world more similar to how they, or pushing the world in the direction they want to see it go. And so businesses that can't articulate, and I'm not saying that every business has to have the same sort of mission, right? There could be businesses that have different things that they really care about and different futures they're trying to go create. But if articulating your mission ends with creating shareholder value, you are not going to be able to attract the best people, because the best people in today's world are, you know, want to align themselves and their efforts with a mission that's bigger than them. And so I feel very, very strongly about that. And I think, again, in a knowledge-based economy, the caliber of people that you can attract is directly correlated to the financial outcome of the business.
I know I have to let you go soon, so maybe just to stump you on the way out, or at least ask you something a little bit tougher. How do you balance socially responsible investing with algorithmically driven investing? Because, you know, of course, if you democratize things, then more or less things should even out and everybody should be represented. But at the same time, you do seem to have a somewhat altruistic mission, but you want to be algorithmically driven. So what happens if you, in your head, say that we want to have X percent of investments in a particular group that has been underserved historically, and you just can't quite get there using your algorithm? Does that mean algorithms are bad, or does that mean it has to be tweaked, or is that something you can live with if you're at least doing better than other backers, I guess you could say?
Yeah. Look, it's a discussion we have internally quite a bit, because we do want to move the needle, and we think that that's part of our mission. But I think things get very slippery when you start to mess with algorithms to create specific outcomes, especially if you don't understand what those, you know, how those things start to how those, the externalities and the follow-on effects of that. And so the way we do that is we say, look, if we think that there is an underrepresented community that we would like to invest in, or if there's a type of business, right? If we have people that are, you know, building sustainable businesses or focusing on climate change and we care about that, then what we'll try and do is we'll try and go and where do those entrepreneurs hang out, right? Let's go fill the top of the funnel, right? So if we're looking for underprivileged youth, like, let's say, right? So like from the Black community or Latin community that we want to go fund, how do we find those entrepreneurs? How do we tell them about ClearCo? How do we tell them that if they're building this type of business that we're here? We're not going to put our thumb on the scale on the algorithm and say, actually, it's easier for you than the white Stanford grad who is building a business. We're not going to go do that. But in all likelihood, that underrepresented kid probably doesn't even know we exist. And so we can put in a little bit more effort to let them know that we exist. And that's sort of the way that we, so without messing with the algorithm and without sort of focusing, you know, messing on the purity of that, we can still try and get to a closer, you know, get to the outcomes that we're looking for by putting a bigger effort in where we market and where we focus in our awareness efforts.
Well, far be it from me to grade an answer, but I think that's a very difficult question and a pretty good answer in a very difficult environment, you know, trying to figure out how do you do good, but also do well ultimately as a for-profit company. So,
well, our investors, you know, our investors and our capital providers, I think, wouldn't let us go very far if they were like, well, you're depressing your returns because you're messing with your algorithm to create it, you know, and so it ends up being a very, very circular view. So we say, look, we have a high standard. We will allow companies to get funding and we'll scale that funding as they need it. And then we also provide a lot of advice and coaching for entrepreneurs because we see a lot of what works and what doesn't work. And so we can actually, you know, improve. That's where we can put our thumb on the scale is, hey, look, if you allocate your capital this way, this will make your business more valuable. This will get you to your goals faster. And that's where we think we can really have an impact. But just, you know, tweaking the decisioning algorithm can get to, you know, this similar issues that we see in today's world.
Exactly. And I think we all know, we've all read a little bit about that lately. So this is really fascinating. Andrew, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. Great to have the conversation. And thanks for having me on.
Thanks again to Andrew for making the time. I really think it's an interesting approach, and I think it does kind of show that you can do well and by at the same time trying to make money. Those two things are not opposites, as they're often framed in the media. If you'd like what you just heard, and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and B. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.